This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith today, we're talking with a very frequent guest, it turns out, on Keeping the Faith. I was trying to count up how many times Jeannie Murray Walker, the poet and playwright, professor at University of Delaware, how often she'd been on the show. And I remember when the University of Illinois published one of her six or seven books of poetry, A Deed to the Light, back in 2004. She was a guest here. And then later in 2009, when Erdmann's published New Tracks, Night Falling, another book of her poetry, she was on the phone with us, sharing some of those wonderful poems. And then once with Leslie Leyland Fields, whose book came out in 2010 on the spirit of food. We had both of them on the line. So this has been a lot of fun, Jeannie, following your most recent career. Good to have you again.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
We'll be talking today about her most recent book. It's actually not even formally out yet. It comes out, I think it's September 3rd. Is that right, Jeannie?
Yeah, that's the date.
And people can order it in advance, of course, but it's called The Geography of Memory, A Pilgrimage Through Alzheimer's. It's a memoir. It's really a fine book. I'd even go so far as to call it one of the great books I've read in the last several years. It's a wonderful sharing of family memories, and it's very insightful. It's prose, but very poetic prose, and I'm delighted to talk about it here on the show for an hour. Let me say, let me start off by pointing out that I'm not the only one who is really moved by this book. I was reading what some other folks have written, and Mark Knoll, a well-known professor of history at Notre Dame, said this: "This deeply humane memoir is at once a memorial to a mother, whose memory failed before her body gave way, a poignant reflection on the sister who lived close by while the author flew in repeatedly from afar, and an insightful exposition on memory itself, with a poet's eye for the apt image. The Geography of Memory is also a casebook of spiritual disciplines, taught by what Jeannie Murray Walker calls the ugly twins, aging and death. A casebook of spiritual disciplines taught by aging and death." Well, Jeannie, I'm glad your most recent book is getting fine reviews, including mine. What have you heard about it?
Not a whole lot yet because it isn't out, but and you know how it is when you're a writer, you're kind of looking back in the rearview mirror at the one you wrote 2 years ago and kind of looking forward at the next to the next one. But I've been delighted by the reviews, too.
Your publisher sent me an uncorrected proof, and I'll send you my little sheet of errata, but they've probably already found all those things already, but not much, just a couple little things. But what a good book. Now, tell me, When did you take notes as you were going through the last 10 years of your mother's life after she was beginning to show signs of mental difficulty?
I didn't take notes. I had no idea that I was going to write this book. I was really focused on working and raising children and kind of catch as catch can. I flew to Dallas when I really needed to, which was maybe six times a year, and I would stay 5 days or so and go through the closets and clean everything and make sure that mother's friends were still on board with her and do whatever I needed to do, take her to restaurants and, you know, spend some time with her. It was only really 4 years after she died that I...
And what year was that?
Well, it was 2007. So it was after that, you know, sometime after that, that I went back and tried to reconstruct and became very aware of how unstable memory is. I had to go back to Dallas and take a look at all the doctor's offices we'd been in and the houses where she had lived and all of her facilities that she had been in because memory is so tricky.
Your book really deals with memory over and over again, and it's a substantial book. It's not intimidating in any way, but 360 pages, it's obviously a book that you've put your heart into, and it really repays careful reading. But I kept having trouble reading it because it would call forth memories from my life. And then I'd have to go and write something, or I'd have to go talk to my wife or something. And so it's an evocative book, and that's a great thing. But on the other hand, I kept interrupting myself trying to read it.
Well, good. I think if it's a memory device for the people who read it and a kind of companion, that's better than anything I can imagine. I really thought of it, I think, maybe as a companion for people who were thinking about Alzheimer's or maybe caregiving through Alzheimer's. And that's what a companion should do. It should elicit stories from the reader as well as, you know, the stories that are in the book. So I'm delighted.
Let me give our listeners an opportunity to call in and perhaps share some of their memories that our conversation may bring out of them. This is a live call-in show, and because it's archived and people may be listening to this on their various devices, computers and phones and iPads and so forth, at any time, let me remind people that we are talking in the summer, July of 2013, live. And if you're hearing this show live over WILL AM 580 or 90.9 FM HD3, you may call us and join this conversation. We're eager to have you share your memories, ask questions, make comments. You may do that anywhere the program is heard by punching in 800-222-9455. If it's a local call, please use one of our local lines, 217-333-9455. So again, long distance, 222-WILL, that's an 800 number. Locally, if you're the 217 area code, 333-WILL. Jeannie, I thought I'd ask you to read a little something from your memoir, The Geography of Memory, A Pilgrimage Through Alzheimer's, that's coming out this September. I'm looking at page 190. And at this point, you were talking about moving your mother, and it was a difficult move because a person who's having trouble talking and thinking and remembering things, that's going to be hard to dislocate someone. But that middle paragraph on page 190, and I have the uncorrected proof, that talks about the word fundamentalist. Your mother was a fundamentalist all her life, and that's the way you were raised, a Christian who was very conservative. You've changed, we might even say radically, but why don't you read that paragraph for us?
Okay. The word fundamentalist isn't used much anymore, except to ridicule and denigrate conservative Christians. I don't use it that way, either here or ever. Fundamentalists were my first people, the kin I loved more instinctively than I have loved anyone since. Our friends at Temple Baptist Church, friends of all ages who picnicked with us, went to school with us, and brought us food, whether we were celebrating or grieving. We knew they were quietly, constantly praying for us. My mother, who was loyal to the core of her being, never abandoned the fundamentalist ideas she and my father chose when they were in their 20s.
And then you go on to say in the next paragraph that you are the one who changed, not that you planned to, you just discovered one day you were incapable of believing what you had been taught. And the road you traveled away from Christian fundamentalism, you say, was long and thorny and lonely and dangerous. You had no idea where you'd end up. No one helped you. You're not even sure you could explain the stations along that road you write. And yet you can't imagine, you say, the way back. And yet here you were, a college professor, author of books and plays, and a world traveler, and an Episcopalian at this point in your life, who you say you defined your faith more by perhaps doubt than by belief, at least partially. You mentioned that in your book. So how could you, your mother and you communicate, especially at this time of your life when she's suffering from Alzheimer's?
Well, I think we communicated in the way that we always did, through stories, mainly. She was a wonderful storyteller. And, of course, I grew up to write stories or to use metaphor in the way that she did, but she didn't actually categorize it and think about what she was doing so much in the way that many people don't. They just, they're good at it, that's all. So we communicated in that way, and probably in more physical ways, through food, through sharing spaces. She was a great gardener. She just loved flowers and knew all their Latin names. She was a national flower show judge by the time she, I don't know, got to be about 60. And so she taught me how to arrange flowers. And she, you know, it was that kind of physical stuff that we communicated through. I don't think my mother was ever interested particularly in dogma. She was, or even theology. She wasn't particularly interested in whether I shared that with her because she couldn't really talk about it much herself. So we had plenty in common, even as she aged and kind of lost track of language and things.
Now, in your earlier years, you describe in your book, The Geography of Memory, there were times when you were just absolutely furious with your mother.
Well, that's right. I think, among other things, this book is a story of a very fierce mother-daughter battle, and that I distanced myself from her when I was married at the age of, you know, 23 or 24 years old, and really never planned to have a very close relationship with her because she chose a whole different way of life and had a church and friends that I really didn't feel at home with. And so these last 10 years of really helping to take care of her with my sister and her husband and also my wonderful husband were a big surprise to me because we began to share memories and of the past. And I got to know her in a way that I probably would never have been able to know her if she hadn't had Alzheimer's. So in a way, they were a gift, that getting close to my mother at the end of her life.
Now you have a living sister. Your brother died when he was 18, just after he had started college. Your father died when your mother was how old?
Oh, she was in her late 30s when my father died, and she raised the three of us by herself.
She went into nursing. She nurses in those years weren't paid all that well, but she found ways by living frugally to raise three children. But these significant losses, losing a husband when you're in your 30s, you're left with three small children. And then to have your oldest child, your only son, die at age 18. Tremendous losses.
Tremendous losses. It's really hard for me to even imagine them, although I suffered them as a child from a different point of view. And my mother never lost her. She was very courageous, and I think she kind of had her back against the wall. She felt as if she didn't maybe have any choice. And she loved her work, and that helped. And she was, she had an enormous amount of just plain physical stamina, which helped a lot. And she was very funny. She was a very funny woman. I think this book, even though it's about Alzheimer's, always goes back to that sense of humor she had. She was raised on a farm. She always had a kind of laconic, ironic point of view on contemporary, sophisticated city life. And so all of that sustained her, and of course her faith. It did sustain her. And, you know, I have to give her that. It was absolutely wonderful to be raised by somebody who had that sense of optimism.
But you could also see why the certainty of Christian fundamentalism would appeal to her when her life had been so unstable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, she didn't, in some ways, she never had the luxury of being able to doubt. Somebody has said, and I can't remember who it was, and you probably will remember, Steve, but I can't.
Not likely. I'm older than you.
Well, I think it's one of the, you know, existentialist theologians who said the opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is fear. And I don't know that my mother was ever afraid.
Some of our listeners may be able to correct that, may correct me, but I think that may have been Paul Tillich. I may be wrong, but perhaps that's right.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We do welcome calls to even correct the hosts. It's fine. Yeah, the opposite of faith is not doubt, but fear. Yeah. Your brother was still alive when your father died, so there were three of you children. And then when your brother died during his freshman year in college, at 18, he'd been ill before, he'd not been well, but it still came as a shock.
Well, it did. We had taken him to school the week before and dropped him off there and, you know, I just figured he's on to this wonderful thing where he gets to be on campus and do anything he wants. I was there for a short time, but I could see how good it was going to be for him. And I think it was a Friday after we dropped him off at college that the chaplain called and told us that he had died during the night. He was an asthmatic. He was a very serious asthmatic all of his life. And I think the reason that he survived it all was that my mother was a very gifted nurse, and that he was just, you know, with all the shock and difficulty that happens with freshmen, and I see that every year in the fall. We have kids coming to campus, and it's a rough year for them. For a lot of the freshmen, not all of them, certainly, but, you know, that probably combined with what was an asthmatic attack, and he was in the health center when he died. So it was a very big shock, and, of course, desperately difficult for my mother.
As a campus pastor for many years at two different universities, I've made those calls to parents when the dean of students calls and wants someone who's done it before to make those horrible telephone calls to a parent about the death of a child.
Well, I've got to tell you, I think it can make a difference who calls.
Yeah.
When Evan Welch called my mother,
He was the chaplain.
The chaplain. He was, there was something about, you know, he comforted her.
Mm-hmm.
And he left her with something afterwards. So I think the calls you made probably made a difference to the people who got them.
Now, one of the things that appealed to you about your brother going off to college was he did escape your mother. And she could be rather tyrannical, and you show that side of her, too. I want to talk about that in just a minute, but we're at 20 minutes into our program today on Keeping the Faith with the author and professor and playwright Jeannie Murray Walker. Her name is spelled J-E-A-N-N-E, Burry, M-U-R-R-A-Y, Walker, W-A-L-K-E-R. She's the author of the book we're talking about, The Geography of Memory, A Pilgrimage Through Alzheimer's. Let's go to a notice about a program that will be here tomorrow on WILL AM and FM 90.9.
Rick Steves doesn't just know how to travel. He knows the why of traveling. He learned early on about the rewards of meeting new people in new places. He's talked about it on his public radio and TV programs. And earlier this year, he talked about travel on Focus prior to his March visit here to meet friends of WILL. I'm Jim Meadows. Tune in for an encore presentation of Focus with guest Rick Steves, Monday morning at 10 on AM 580.
That's tomorrow morning, Monday, July of 2013, here on AM 580, WILL, and 90.9 FM HD3. And you can hear that program at your convenience, as all of our encore or archive programs are available via going to the website will.illinois.edu. Jeannie, travel was important to you. We were just talking about the fact that your late brother got away to college was something that when you got to be that age, that was something you were looking forward to. But when you told your mother you wanted to go to the same college as your brother, she couldn't stand the thought of you going there and after what had happened to him, and so she came with you.
She did. And I knew that I wouldn't be able to go if she wasn't helping me pay for it. So I didn't really have too much choice.
So she packed up your sister, Julie, who was, 3 years younger than you?
She was, yeah.
And came along and lived in the same town while you started college.
Absolutely. Now, the one thing, you know, that, I mean, it's a kind of frightening story when you hear that, because she was very controlling. And she said to me, when I told her I was going to go off to school, but I can't lose another child that way. That's where I sent him, and he never came back, or he came back in a box, you know. And so I understood that. I was always pretty empathetic about it. But when I got to school, when we all moved there, she swore to me that she would leave her hands off me. And it turned out to be better for me than it was for most of the young women in the dorms, because they had a curfew, and I had no curfew. And there were times when I was really out until 3 or 4 in the morning, and I'm sure my mother was awake, but she really abruptly left off all of that controlling at that point, and I really don't know exactly how she did it, except that she was, at that point, I think perhaps thinking about remarrying and thinking about her own future.
Now, was she also more lenient for your younger sister, Julie, who was still in high school at that time, than she had been with you when you were in high school?
Sure seemed to me she was.
But I noticed sibling rivalry shows up several times in this book, and you talk about it very openly in some chapters. Other chapters, I thought I was detecting it when maybe even you didn't.
Well, you know, I've given my sister this book to read twice, and she's passed on it. So
she might write her version later?
Oh, well, she might, absolutely. I don't know. You know, it's dangerous to write memoirs. I found out when I was writing this, it's the first memoir I've ever written, and the poetry that I write is not necessarily autobiographical. So everybody who's an actor in the story sits in a different chair and has a different point of view. And it doesn't necessarily agree with the way you tell the story.
Sure.
So it's sort of dangerous, but you tell what you know. It's your story. You witnessed it.
Let me give the phone numbers again for listeners who might like to join this conversation with Jeannie Murray Walker. Professor Walker teaches at University of Delaware. She's talking with us by phone today about her book, The Geography of Memory, A Pilgrimage Through Alzheimer's, published, coming out just in this September. The phone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois area, punch in 333-9455. to connect with to us by local lines. If it's a long-distance call for you, you may use an 800 number 222-9455. Jeannie, when you talk about your family in this book and talk about this relationship with your mother that changed over all those years, you talk about your life changing and how you changed. Since we just we interrupted ourselves here to advertise a program about travel and Rick Steves tomorrow. Travel was very important to you. Tell about how your mother reacted when you said you wanted to go to Peru.
Well, my mother had never had a chance to travel. She was born on a farm and had stayed in the Midwest most of her life, all of her life, really, until she remarried and went to Dallas. And she thought it was dangerous to travel, and it probably was. I flew to Lima and then took a bus over the Andes, and we saw a bunch of 30 iron crosses down on the side of the Andes. And the bus took 45 hours to get to the middle of the jungle, and then I was in the jungle for 3 months.
And the iron crosses represented buses and other vehicles that had gone over the edge of the mountain, and people had died.
That's sure what I imagined, yeah.
No, I know that's true because my spouse was in Peru and was able to ask questions about them.
Yeah, and those drivers, who were probably wonderful drivers, were nevertheless tearing along those very curvy roads, which were extremely narrow. And so, she was probably right, it was dangerous.
And there were landslides.
Absolutely. And furthermore, there was a revolution going on in Lima at the time.
What years were you there? I mean, what year? Were you there one summer, right?
Yeah, it was one summer. It was 65, I think.
How did she end up dealing with it?
Your mother? She made me phone her every 2 weeks on a shortwave radio, which I was happy to do. I kept telling her I was going to bring home a monkey, and I really wanted to. They were so cute. And they were, they were pets to the people I knew in the jungle. So I think she reluctantly let me go, and there isn't really much a parent can do about that. One way or another, the kid's going to leave home.
You talk about the difficulty of your mother when the signs of Alzheimer's began to appear, and you say, and I quote, on page 125, "The woman who built my identity, I see as losing her own." What were your emotions?
It's very disorienting. I think there's some sense in which if you've had a stable, good parent, as so many of us have, it's like, I don't know, what is it like? It's like the tree that marks the driveway where you turn in at night. You expect it to always be there. And if something starts happening to that identity, something starts happening to your own identity as well. It's very disorienting to have a parent drift into Alzheimer's.
When you talk about the disorientation that you went through, you talk very openly about how little you knew often what was right and what you should do. And what would be possible for you to do and still keep some sliver of your own identity as a college professor and writer and so on, and mother and spouse.
Well, I think it's something that probably happens to everybody who needs to be a caretaker or who feels the responsibility of being a caretaker. Nobody else made me do this. I felt I needed to take care of her because she had taken care of me.
And your sister had the same emotions.
Absolutely.
And yet she was in the same city or close to the same city.
Yeah.
Dallas area.
Exactly. Yeah. We both had the same feelings. And what is kind of interesting, and, you know, in our family we had two siblings left, so the two of us needed to be on the same page about everything, and we conferred about her doctors. I have literally hundreds and hundreds of emails back and forth between us, which I tend to save emails, so I went back to them to construct this book. That's part of how I was able to recover the details. And we were pretty good about agreeing about things. Nobody simply made decisions and left the other one out. And I think it was sometimes very difficult to come to those decisions. It would take weeks. And we would not always agree about the stage she was at, or we didn't even know there was any stage at the beginning. We just knew she was not able to keep track of her checkbook. She was losing track of a lot of items. All the glasses we got her got lost, and we used to take her to Kinhaven in the summer, which is a summer music camp where our son was. And the night that we drove her there, she wandered around the woods, the Vermont woods, all night long because she didn't know where she was. Well, that was not typical of her.
And that was after disrupting the concert, right?
It was, yeah. It was, I mean, she kind of shuffled down the aisle, and this was very, very uncharacteristic behavior. She was an extremely proper and, careful and socially aware human being. So,
but she was still standing, as I remember your report of that, your record of that, when the director came out to start the concert, and her grandson had been the concert master that particular night, and she was still standing, fussing with her clothes and coats and things when the conductor was trying to start the first number.
Yes, and because this kind of thing never happened to us before, we were trying to figure out what was going on. What the surprise is, in retrospect, you know, that your mother was going into the early stages of Alzheimer's, but at the very beginning, you don't know. And I tried to, you know, get that feeling in the book of, this is all new. This is all new to us. And that's one of the hard things about coping. If you can just get a diagnosis right away, then at least you can deal with the hard facts. But we never got a diagnosis for her.
Even after she was moved to the Alzheimer's unit of the care center?
Well, I think Alzheimer's is not diagnosable except after death. And that may be why we never got a diagnosis. But I think this may happen to many people, that the uncertainty about what's going on is part of the difficulty.
We're about halfway through our show today, Keeping the Faith, live this July 2013. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host of this program. But let me say again how grateful I am for the substitute hosts who have helped me over the last 14 years. As I approach the next month, will be the last for me to be here with Keeping the Faith. It's been a wonderful run. I've enjoyed volunteering very much for WILL and hosting this program and producing it and finding guests like Jeannie Murray Walker today, our author of The Geography of Memory. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be interviewing Jim Hires, who is the director of the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, and we'll be talking about how the food bank helps those who are desperately in need of food in this region of the country. And the week after that, we have a very special guest, Carrie Newcomer, the singer and songwriter who's internationally known. We'll be talking with her by phone here on Keeping the Faith. We're just delighted to have someone with her commitment to justice issues and peace issues, with all of her skills and talents on that show. So we're trying to end Keeping the Faith here with some really sterling folks, and I'm delighted that we can talk with Jeannie Murray Walker today, and we'll be talking with some other people that should be a delight in this last month of my being on the show. So that's coming up ahead on Keeping the Faith. Let me just mention also that here locally in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana will be presenting a choral concert next Sunday, that's July 28th, at 7:30 at the Chapel of St. John the Divine, the Episcopal Church on campus. That's at 1101 South Wright Street, corner of Armory and Wright. It costs $10. You can buy tickets at the door, or you can go to BaroqueArtists.org and order tickets in advance. They're doing not only Baroque pieces for this concert, it's Bach and beyond. So there'll be Brahms and Rachmaninoff and Benjamin Britten and a very contemporary composer, Eric Whitaker. So you'll be hearing Britten's Rejoice in the Lamb, and so it should be a wonderful concert. I can say that because I'm not singing with that group this summer because I had too many conflicts and couldn't get to rehearsals, but it is a group I enjoy being with, and Chet Alwis is a fine conductor, and people will enjoy that concert. Next Sunday, 7:30, Chapel of St. John the Divine on the University of Illinois campus, July 28, 2013. Well, let's get back. I do have one other announcement. Unfortunately, I will not be able to introduce another poet, introduce his new book. It came to me too late to schedule since I'm running out of time with the programs just going through August. Dan Guillory, who has been on the show before with his poems about the life of Lincoln, has come out with a new book called House Poems, Structures and Their Inhabitants. Houses everything from the White House in Washington, D.C., to very common homes, farms, for example. He has a wonderful collection of poems called House Poems by Dan Guillory. His last name is spelled G-U-I-L-L-O-R-Y. It is out, published by Mayhaven Publishing Company, and I've read enough of it to know it's a very interesting book, and so I recommend it to you, although we will not be able to schedule Dan Guillory to be on the show since I've run out of time. And I've had a couple questions over the last several weeks whether this was my choice to bring this show to my part of this show to an end, and it has been. I'm now 70, and although I don't think I have Alzheimer's, my memory is failing. it's getting harder to produce the show since I'm not as active in the community as I have been in past years, and finding guests, although it's a happy chore, is a chore. And so I'm calling things to come to an end, and WILL has been very gracious to me over the last 14 years, leaving me to do this show as I wished and to get guests as I chose. And I've tried to have a diverse group of guests, and I'll miss it, but all good things must come to an end.
I would like to add my thanks, Steve, for all the shows that you've done. I frequently check them out online, or, you know, one way or another, and I've been grateful, as many, many other people have, I know, for your wonderful show over the years.
Well, it's been fun for me to do, and it is possible to keep downloading them, as far as I know, into the foreseeable future. So I was trying to figure out, I guess there are almost 700 shows over those years, and so there's quite a library. Well, let's get back to talking about your great book here, The Geography of Memory. Now, did you pick that title?
I did. I did pick the title.
I know often publishers make that decision, and I wasn't sure if that was your choice or theirs. How did you come up with it?
I don't remember exactly what the process was. I was very interested in the fact that my mother was losing her memory because I spent thousands of hours with her. I was gaining memories from the past that I had simply lost track of. I had been you know, moving pretty fast with children and a job, and so I hadn't had too much time for reflection. So I was interested in the idea of, you know, the memories. Memory deal went two ways. I gained things, really, these memories from the past as she was losing her memory. And it was really because of the comments that she made in the story she referred to and so forth that I was able to recoup some of those memories.
Now, you mentioned in your book, and you've repeated, that you spent thousands of hours on the phone and visiting your mom, but of course your sister Julie was there in Dallas and was seeing her weekly and spending thousands more with her. You mentioned the difficulties the two of you had sometimes in agreeing on what was the best course of action, and you talk at one point in your book very movingly about there were times you were just very angry with her, and yet there was a time that it came to your life when you sort of were able to see things a bit from her perspective.
Well, that's true. I think I don't think that any siblings can possibly avoid some kind of sibling rivalry. And if what you're doing is taking care of a parent together, there can be some rivalry involved in that as well. There were times when I questioned the doctors that were chosen because they were close or something like that. And I, you know, we did have these differences of opinion, but we managed to always work through them in the end, though they were sometimes very difficult and sharp.
We have a caller waiting on line number one. Let's go to line one. Yes.
Hi, I'm so excited to read your book. I look forward to getting a copy of it. I have just two quick questions, and I'll take your answer off the air. I was wondering if you had read Proust, Remembrances of Things Past, although that's not the actual translation many people prefer, and did that by any chance have an influence on your thinking about memory? And secondly, to what extent did you have to deal with, or did your siblings have to deal with, guilt about the past with respect to your mother? And I'll hang up and take your answer off the air. Thank you.
So thank you for the call. Could you hear all that, Jeannie?
Yes, I did hear that, and I did read Proust, and I think that I did
en
not
français?
Read... Pardon?
En français? In French?
No. I think I was probably 22 when I read it. And I think the age you are when you read Proust must make a difference. I don't know that I really understood what Proust was trying to do. Maybe in retrospect I have a better sense. But I was not a sophisticated enough reader to have Proust really affect me in the way that he would if I read him now. I just think that kind of a layered approach to memory is brilliant and wonderful, and the books are fabulous. But I can't claim that I was really influenced by them while I was writing this.
And yet you clearly have done research in not only loss of memory and not only Alzheimer's, but you've also done research in preparation for writing this book on the philosophy of memory and the history of some of the wonderful writings in the religious tradition, in the secular tradition, about memory, going back to the Greeks.
Yeah, and I think the book is a lot about memory. And I think also that when I say I wasn't influenced by Proust, that may be not quite true, because I know what Proust was doing, and I think that kind of layering where he sets down an image and then 400 pages later he brings it back is precisely the way memory works in this book. He's a terribly important influence in all of our understandings of memory. And I think, you know, the contemporary period has been a lot about memory. We're obsessed with it. And so what a good question. Now, the other question, guilt. Guilt about the past.
Right.
I don't think that I dealt with a great deal of guilt about my mother. And part of it has to do with what you were referring to, Steve, that in order to get away from her, I really had to be determined to get away. And I don't think that I ever hurt her on purpose. But, you know, the alternative would have been to really never develop any identity at all. And some people who are listening probably can identify with that. She just didn't have the luxury, because she had lost people, my father and my brother. She didn't have the luxury of letting us go easily. And so... So I didn't really deal with a lot of guilt.
I started off this program by saying what a great book this was, I thought, and I am a fan, obviously, but let me be a little critical at this point. I have come to believe over the years that we are what we remember. And so I guess I'm not being critical. I'm just disagreeing with one of the conclusions I think you come to in this book, where you say, you felt your mother had an identity even after she had totally lost her mind.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, though, I didn't know whether she had totally lost her mind. I remember looking at her and thinking, how much does she know about what's going on? And she was never very theoretical, so I couldn't ever talk to her very much about theory, like the theory of memory, and so I never settled that question about what is she thinking? How is her mind operating at the moment? But I definitely had the sense that she had an identity, and maybe that, I don't know, maybe she didn't. I certainly see what you mean about memory being fundamental to your past. What would happen with her, and what I talk about quite a lot in the book, is that she would resurface old selves, like her 34-year-old self, or herself when she was 12, or something like that. And I had a feeling that I was glimpsing, almost they were like characters in a play that lived inside of her, that would pop out for short periods of time. And so I don't know how much of that she lost. I think she lost control of it. She lost maintaining an identity in the real world. She lost track of those, you know, characters and identities inside of her. But I don't know. It's an interesting question.
We're down to our last 5 or 6 minutes of Keeping the Faith today with the author Jeannie Murray Walker, J-E-A-N-N-E, Murray, M-U-R-R-A-Y, Walker, W-A-L-K-E-R, The Geography of Memory, coming out this September. I want to thank Don Nolan, who was our last caller. I recognized his voice. He's been a frequent guest host on this show, and I want to thank him and Stan Yanchis and Becca Guyette and others who have helped over the years, Danny Otto, when I was traveling. Jeannie, let me read one portion of your book that talks about the point you were just making about you and your mother. I'm reading from page 173. That summer at Kinhaven, that's the music camp your son went to, that summer at Kinhaven was the first time I had thought about how my mother was really a composite of many selves, selves I recognized, selves I was familiar with. It made sense to me that surely, as I told my son, each of us carries our history with us. We are all multiple in that way. But we steady ourselves in the present moment, so we will seem predictable and sane to our friends and families. I thought that was quite wonderful.
Well, you know, I don't know whether that's true, but you can go back to when you were a kid and access a lot of that, at different stages. How we hold all that together in the present is kind of a mystery.
You talk about your own present faith as a mystery, as having doubts. In what sense, then, is it a faith?
I think at the heart of my faith is my belief that the universe is comic. Not funny, not a joke, but that the end is happy. And I don't know exactly what I mean by that, but I don't see it as tragic. I don't even see this story as tragic. So I think that's the essence of faith. You have to have faith, or at least I have to have faith, to believe that things are going to end well.
Now, at times in your book, you can get a little caustic. Is that fair to say?
I don't know. Is it true?
Well, let me read a sentence. At the heart of my own faith lies not certainty but mystery and not a little doubt. What faith I have depends on silence and reverence before the force that moves the sun and stars. It has very little to do with cheerfulness or with inviting Jesus into my heart.
Well, that's true. I see your point. Yeah, it's less about that kind of language and a template, and more about desperate hope, which Paul talks about, actually, in the letters that he wrote.
Was the Bible a source of conflict between you and your mother, the different ways you two read it? Or were there times when it could bring you together?
I think it always brought us together because we remembered the words together, and they would be the words of the King James, which was something she really believed was the Bible, and no other translation was the Bible.
Would do, yeah.
But I think also when I was growing up, she didn't really want me to read, and that was a source of great controversy and difficulty between us. And she didn't want me to read because she thought it was lazy to sit in a chair for such a long time. So she was all about literal action in the physical world. And yes, I think that metaphor and reading was a real source of difference between us.
You use metaphor in your poetry, of course, as poets inescapably do. Metaphor is a theme throughout this book, as well as the multiplicity of personalities. It's very difficult to talk about metaphor, I think, sometimes, but you have practice at that. What would you tell our listeners in the 2 minutes we have remaining, or three, about metaphor?
Well, I would say something quite practical. If you happen to be a caregiver to an Alzheimer's patient, listen really carefully to the images they use, to the specific things they refer to, and see whether they're talking about their own stories, things that have happened to them in the past. And it may help you to decipher something about what they mean. And the reason that's valuable to you, not only to them but also to you, is because it cuts the isolation. I think one of the hard things about taking care of an Alzheimer's patient is it is very isolating for both you and the patient. And this metaphor that they use, these images, can sometimes give you a clue to where they are and what they're thinking.
We've had several programs over the last 3 years about Alzheimer's and related problems that people have with aging, with their memory, with their knowledge of where they are and what they're doing. I would encourage listeners who want to learn more about this, who might have missed earlier shows. There was one with Professor Charles Cowger that we had about dementia. And another one about Alzheimer's, also a memoir. And right now, My mind is slipping, and I'm not remembering the title. Sorry about that. But the author is Osler, O-S-L-E-R. You could go to will.illinois.edu, and in the search engine, just put the name Osler, and her name will show up in the title of her book, and you can hear that interview as well. Jeannie, it's been a delight talking with you again, and thank you for this wonderful book, The Geography of Memory, A Pilgrimage Through Alzheimer's, Jeannie Murray Walker. Tell us in 30 seconds how your name is spelled and why it's pronounced the way it is.
Because my mother told me to pronounce it this way.
And she thought Jeannie was spelled J-E-A-N-N-E.
Yeah, she had never, you know, she knew no French, so there you go. It has been a pleasure to talk with you again, Steve. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Coming up again next week, we'll be talking with Jim Hires on Keeping the Faith about the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. Be sure to join us for that. And again, in the following week, we have a real treat with Carrie Newcomer, the singer and songwriter. It should be a wonderful show coming up here on Keeping the Faith. Again, let me mention the book of another poet, Dan Guillory, a professor emeritus from Millikan University in Decatur, Illinois, who we've had on this show before. His newest book of poems is called House Poems, Structures and Their Inhabitants, published by Mayhaven Publishing. It is out and available. That's a very interesting book of poetry that sadly I will not be able to interview the author about because the program coming to an end in just another month, in August, end of August. And again, a reminder about the concert coming up by the Broke Artists of Champaign-Urbana, 7:30 on July 28 at the Chapel of St. John the Divine, directed by Chet Alwis, Bach, and Beyond. They'll be performing music by Johannes Brahms, Sergei Rachmaninoff, Benjamin Britten, and Eric Whitaker. Again, that's Chapel of St. John the Divine on the campus of the University of Illinois, 1101 South Wright Street, Champaign, 7:30, July 28th, the year 2013. Remember, you can listen to archive programs of Keeping the Faith and all other locally produced shows like Focus here by going on your various electronic devices to will.illinois.edu. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD3. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear revelations from well-known actors, like Zach Galifianakis on the story behind his last name.
It's actually shortened, Terry. My real last name is Galifianakisberg. So, you know, that's an exclusive for your show.
Fresh Air, bringing you some of the biggest names in American culture and some of the most difficult to pronounce. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
This week on the Evening Concert, we'll have Beethoven's 5th and 8th symphonies from Deutsche Welle Radio. Then Emanuel Ax, the piano soloist in Haydn's 11th piano concerto from New York. Wednesday, pianist Einon Barnatan plays Bach's G minor keyboard concerto in Santa Fe. Then Thursday, it's part 2 of our 2-part special on conductor Eric Leinsdorf. Friday, it's Prairie Performances with Roger Cooper. That's the Evening Concert, Monday through Friday evenings at 7 on FM 90.9.
On the way at 7, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. In the first part, the future of city living. Then at 8, the topic is memory and forgetting. New Dimensions is up at 9, and Le Show is at 10. But up next, it's This American Life with Ira Glass and Stories of Summer Camp. I'm Jason Croft, and this is Illinois Public Media, WILL AM 580 and WILL FM 90.9 HD3 Urbana. You can also find a full list of our programs on our website at will.illinois.edu.